This is episode 47 of Free As in Freedom. I'm Karen Sandler.
And I'm Bradley Kuhn.
This is Free As in Freedom.
So you have a topic you want to discuss.
Yeah. Well, in the interest of summarizing the topic at the beginning of the episode, I would like to discuss why software freedom is so important to us.
To who?
To me and you.
Oh. Just us?
Well, I mean, I think that that we're really passionate about software freedom. We work to forward software freedom all the time, and we talk about it a lot in at conferences, and it underlies everything that we talk about in our podcast. But at the same time, I don't think that we've really taken the time to sort of explain why we care so much.
Well, I used to give, though long ago, mm-hmm. I used to give a talk about this. It was sort of, basically, I designed the talk originally because RMS said I needed a talk that was just like his when I went to work for him.
Wait, so this isn't you disagreeing with me about the topic?
No.
No, this is you just beginning to discuss the topic.
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay, good.
So I had this talk that somebody was asking me on IRC about giving talks about free software, and I told them how bad I was giving that talk when I first gave it in the late 1990s. It was 1989, actually. And eventually I got better at it and gave that talk. And there's a bunch of recordings of that talk. I don't think we would want to include a recording of that talk in this episode itself. I'll link to it because it's available. So there.
So how old is
it? I'm done. Go listen to that. I'm kidding. But I am. That's. I mean, that was what the talk was. The first half of that talk is just designed. And I've been thinking about reviving that talk in some way, for the reason you raised this, right? Because people who are zealots basically tend not to explain why.
Yeah, I mean, we've gotten to the point where it's obvious to us. I mean, or rather, I mean, it underlies so much of what we do that to revisit all the time would be exhausting were we to do it every day anyway, you know, I mean, to go back to basics. But at the same time, I think it's good periodically to focus on the why and think about it. And this is something that I've been thinking about a lot, in part because I've started an initiative for messaging for software freedom, which was actually my keynote at LibrePlanet this year, but it's something that I started working on at the GNU 30th. And I just think it's so hard to explain why software freedom is important to people who don't already understand it, that, you know, we as a movement need to step back and take a look at it. And I sort of have been thinking about it in those terms and observing how my own thoughts about software freedom has changed over time, in part from how I started in the field, really. Well, I guess I started as an engineering school, but like when I went to work at the Software Freedom Law Center, I really thought that free and open source software was cool. And then it wasn't really until, I mean, working with the passionate developers who were my clients convinced me, but then it wasn't really until I needed proprietary software in my implantable medical device that I sort of, you know, I was gonna say got religion about it, but that's not really the right way to describe it, that it really became my passionate cause.
Well, I think that people, I don't mind actually the religious analogy anymore. I've been giving a talk lately where I talk about how religion and politics are the two things you're told as a kid in polite society you're not supposed to discuss. And I think, and I talk about both of them in the talk. That's the talk that actually talks about the issue of transubstantiation and the difference between Roman Catholics and Protestants on the issue. So it really does, it does discuss religion. But I think the similarity to religion is that much of the reasons why I believe in software freedom as a universal human right is an issue of belief, not an issue of fact, in the sense that I can't prove to you that that somehow it's morally wrong. I mean, this is what Kant tried to do, right? Kant tried to find every moral principle and create a logical proof that things were right and wrong. And while I'm a big fan of Kant, that's Immanuel Kant, the philosopher, I don't think you can actually do that. When you believe in something, you can't prove it correct in a mathematical sense or a logician sense.
It's tough because, I mean, if you believe that a position is correct, it doesn't need to be akin to religion. There is, you know, you sort of make the reasonable conclusions that you can based on the facts that you have at hand, and then you go forward in the way that you think is correct, adding new information as you go and being willing to reevaluate. I find that I don't like the analogy to religion at all, because I just feel like I feel like it's a different issue, because we really, I mean, we are basing our views on, you know, on factual understandings from situations that we encounter again and again and again, academic studies that we read.
Well, I didn't base my beliefs about software freedom on any real studies or facts or anything like that. I mean, I felt that's sort of what open source was doing, was trying to say that this is some factually based situation. I, like most religious people, frankly, had a personal experience that made me sure that free software is correct, or a series of personal experiences.
So why don't you, I mean, like, why don't I go into interview mode?
Okay.
why don't you talk? Because I think you might, talk about this in your, I haven't listened to your introduction.
My very old talk.
Your very old talk in a very long time. I did listen to it a long time ago.
Yeah. I think I last delivered it 10 years ago.
I think you recommended it to me when I was relatively new at SFLC.
Mm-hmm. But it's not a bad talk. It's just.
Well, I think you might have a different perspective on it now.
No, I think the first half an hour of that talk, I think, is pretty much what I still believe and what is still basically correct. I never wanted to do anything other than computer science at all. Somebody in college told me once I said something about changing your major or thinking about changing your major. And I was like, I thought about changing my major once. And they said, what, from fireman to computer scientist when you were five or something? You know, because I wanted a computer so badly. And my parents couldn't really afford one. And then the Commodore 64, after it had been on the market for basically 6 or 8 months and the prices went down, my father bought one. Now, my father was a programmer as well. I like to point out that there was a time when insurance companies hired you to write device drivers. He actually wrote IBM 360 device drivers for a mutual insurance company. Because there was a time when you had to do everything on the computer, from writing the actuarial software to device drivers, in the 1970s. And so I grew up in an engineering household. My grandfather was an engineer at Westinghouse back when it was the largest employer in Maryland, eventually ceased to exist in Maryland. And so I had grown up as basically only wanting to be a software developer. That's all I ever had an interest in at all. I mean, it's the only thing I was interested in.
So you were interested before you even had a computer?
Oh, yeah. I very much wanted to get a computer. I don't know.
You don't know?
I have no idea. And I learned BASIC at 11 or 12 and started doing game mods mostly on the 64. So they were all written in 6802 assembler, so you could basically edit the assembler code and basically what most people did. I didn't do anything that advanced. If the simple thing you could do was change the strings, right? So you could put your own name into the characters in the game and that sort of thing. I didn't know 6802 assembler well enough. I only knew BASIC, so I didn't really make any major changes to the programs. I wasn't like one of these people who crack the copy protection on games. I wish I had been, but I was not. And so I was interested in computer programming from the beginning. And so I majored in computer science my freshman year. I mean, I went in with that major declared. I was thinking about double majoring in foreign language, some foreign language or other, but didn't ultimately, and just did a minor, almost a minor in one of them.
So it was actually Emacs that was your first introduction to free software.
Well, I think the story is more complex than that. So my father hired me as a developer, paying me, I think I made $9 an hour to start,
really?
Right out of high school.
Wow.
Which was not bad.
That was a lot
for
of money
1991.
Then.
Yeah, it was not bad, but it was so much less than, I mean, most developers were getting $25 or $30 an hour to do development.
Yeah, but that was before people were, I mean, some people had been dropping out of college for sure long before that, but it was like, it wasn't until, like, you know, when we were leaving college that people were dropping out of college programs.
That's true, but I mean, I think we worked with a couple of consultants at this blood typing laboratory where my father was a contractor for many, many years. At one point they had a lot of funding for software development, and we have four people there total, including me, for a while. And those other guys were charging, the really good one was charging, I think he was charging $55 or $60 an hour in 1991 dollars. And the other guy was charging like $35. So for $9 an hour, I was basically free because every day I worked was an hour they worked. So it was, I was so cheap that it didn't matter that I didn't know anything, except for some Pascal and BASIC. So that was my first time I got access to a Unix machine. And so, I started BASIC. I sort of took to system administration early. I was sort of in charge of that aspect of the system. So I was installing developer tools for people and that sort of thing. And it drove me nuts because VI on that system, you couldn't suspend it because it didn't have job control. This was Unix System 5 release 3.2.3. So it's before it had job control or streams or sockets, which the BSD people would know as, but it was called streams in the System 5 days, early System 5 days. So it had none of that. So you could edit one file at once. And so I downloaded Emacs in part because I was trying to figure out how to edit more than one file at once. Like I have two files open on a, this is an ASCII glass TTY screen, right? And so I downloaded Emacs for that, and that's how I first got introduced to free software. I've told the story on the podcast before, I think, that there was this huge fight between delete and backspace in early Emacs days, and what key should be mapped to backspace, and whether backspace and delete should be the same key, and all this sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And some terminals had Control H as backspace, and Control H was helping Emacs, and there was all this fighting about mapping Control H to backspace, and it was harder to look things. It's hard to talk to young developers today. It was harder to look these things up.
Yeah.
Right. I had Usenet access, but it wasn't constant Usenet access. We downloaded a batch of Usenet every night.
This is why all those VI mugs were so popular when I was in college.
I basically had this, had this problem when I first, no, actually I had to port Emacs by basically commenting code out. Most of my early free software development was commenting code out for broken systems. And so I got Emacs to compile by basically commenting out all the stuff that needed sockets. And so I had it running on the 3b2, and when I got it, I hit Control H thinking I was hitting backspace, and I ended up falling into the menus and seeing the GNU manifesto and the GPL both. So I read them first in 1991.
Now, we recorded an interview with Stallman that I think we never published. Is that right?
Yeah, we should publish that.
We should publish it, because in it, didn't you ask him whether he had
done this on purpose? Well, you can hear his answer when you hear it. So we'll play that at some later date. Anyway, so that's how I first read the GNU Manifesto, and I was somewhat convinced at that point, but it didn't change my life at that point because it didn't change how I thought about things necessarily. It was an interesting. It was kind of like you felt when you first.
Right.
And you thought it was interesting and cool, as you said it.
Yeah.
But it wasn't what I was focusing towards. And I didn't think I was a good enough developer to work on any of this stuff anyway, as far as that. I mean, I always spent my whole development career thinking I wasn't good enough for any of this stuff. So,
I wonder how much more advanced software freedom would be without imposter syndrome.
So anyway, I went to, so this was the summer between my senior year of high school and my freshman year of college. And I went to college and majored in computer science, and they gave us access to a VMS machine, which I never liked. I mean, I learned things about it because that was the machine they gave us access to initially. And I ended up breaking into the Unix machines so I could get a Unix account, and I got in trouble for that, for breaking into the Unix machines. But because I knew some Unix, right? And so
Is that how you got hired?
I never got hired I found out decades later. I went back to give a talk at where I went undergrad, and actually somebody had argued for hiring me, and the sysadmin, she really didn't like me, and so, because I had broken into all her machines, and so they didn't hire me.
Because that's how a couple of the people who I learned from at Cooper Union's computer center had been hired, because they had.
Yeah, in the end, I just got a letter. I thought I was going to get kicked. Stupidly, as a freshman, I thought I was going to get kicked out of school for this, which you probably would never get kicked out of school for that, because I didn't really do anything.
Right.
So, I mean, they sent a letter, basically, to me. So
still terrifying.
And then the worst part was, though, the computer science part wouldn't let me have a Unix account until I needed it for class, which made it longer for me to get a Unix account in the end. Mm. By the end of my time there, I had installed GNU Linux, the lab for the entire, and I was the sysadmin in the lab, but that was mostly a volunteer thing for computer science department, not for the main. The DAX was run by the main IT services. So anyway, the thing was, I became obsessed with Unix, and I got a laptop the end of my freshman year. I saved up to buy a laptop, and I had Windows 3.1 on it. And it was very difficult to get software for it. And the software was expensive if you wanted it. So I often say I came for the free as in price and stayed for the free as in freedom, mm-hmm. because that's what mattered as a student without much money. I was very frustrated that I couldn't find any software. I downloaded a lot of shareware stuff and tried to hack together a system on Windows that I could use for work. To do schoolwork on, and was never able to get there. Around that time, this is some of our older listeners will remember this. There was so Solaris x86 had come out. That was $985 or $895.
I can't remember. All of these little
because
facts?
This was like, such a big deal to me.
I know, but you remember the version of Windows that you had. I can't remember any of this stuff.
Yeah, it wasn't 3.11, by the way. It was 3.1. I remember. Anyway. So
it's amazing to me. I lose so many details.
Anyway, I couldn't afford Solaris x86. It had just come out at that point, and I was like, well, I mean, they might as well said it was $100,000 because $895 was so much money. And this is 1992 dollars at this point. So I actually tried. I was at 91, the end of 91. So I tried this system called Coherent, which this company named the Mark Williams Company released, that was a $99 Unix for PCs. He had bought a System 5 license from AT&T to build a Unix system. It was proprietary, but it was Unix on the PC, and it had all sorts of problems and bugs. And of course, it was proprietary software, so I couldn't fix any of the bugs or even try. It just would crash all the time. And so I was still running Windows 3.1 and Coherent on basically two different drives. It wasn't a dual boot. It was like I switched drives to switch them. And that was frustrating. And at that point, I was reading CompOS Minix because a lot of the Minix people were talking about running Unix on PCs. And I saw go by on Usenet Linus's first post. I read it when it was posted. Mm. I'm fond of saying that. that I actually read his post when he said, not big and professional like GNU, that post. I remember thinking that, well, that's not going to go anywhere. So I admit that I thought that. I was like, well, this guy's going to try to write it from scratch. And there's Minix and there's Coherent and there's nothing else. And I actually posted a lot to CompOS Coherent trying to help people and trying to figure out myself how to get it to work. So I finally, when SLS came out, which that's the precursor to Slackware, it was actually a set of floppies you could install, because most people were installing GNU Linux systems by booting Windows and running a program to bootstrap the kernel, an exe file on Windows, to get the kernel to boot. That's how you got the kernel to boot, because it couldn't boot off a machine. It couldn't really boot off a machine, like from a hard drive. SLS was really the first distribution that was able to make it so you could put a bunch of floppies in and install from scratch. And I did. So then I was running GNU Linux at that point, but this was all about getting a Unix machine on my laptop. Mm. And at that point I was terrified about the future of my career for a different reason. I thought I wasn't going to be able to work with Unix. I thought that there was so much Windows development going on that it was going to be extremely difficult to find a job working just only be willing to do Unix stuff. Mm. So I was pretty worried, actually, that I wasn't going to, I was, from the very beginning, I was worried I wasn't going to be working in my field, because I was not going to work on Windows. That was clear to me. Not for proprietary software reasons. I want to be clear about that. Just right. for technical reasons. Right. All I cared about were the technical reasons. Unix was a better way of looking at things. And I just couldn't imagine ever working on a Windows machine or a Mac. I just would never do it. And so I was, especially once I had SLS installed. But again, I wasn't in the politics at all. I didn't care about the politics at that point. So I graduated and started getting jobs, and I won't tell all these stories because I don't think it's valuable, because I tell them probably better in my talks that I'll link to. But I just had a series of experiences where I was either a developer or a sysadmin, and I was either writing or supporting proprietary software. And Karen's not yawning, so the story's not too long.
Well, I've heard, I mean, yeah. You know, we've
so,
talked about this.
So, but the thing, this is what turned me into a zealot, which was once I got out in my career, and I wrote proprietary software, and I saw how proprietary software companies treated their users. I remember one experience where I found a way to refactor something and told my boss that I could refactor it. And we just had a user group meeting with the users of this proprietary software. It's not even worth explaining what the application was. It's completely pointless. But there were a bunch of users of it who really depended on it and they had complaints. And I said, I remember saying to my boss, I probably used the wrong words. I wouldn't frame it this way now if I were in the same situation. I said, oh, for free, I can get this feature because I can refactor. And they said, he said, can you figure out a way to turn it off? And I was like, well, yeah, but like, why would you do that? And he's like, well, we would want to sell it as an add-on. Mm. And I was like, so we just sat through this user group meeting where users are complaining about this. They're paying monthly maintenance fees anyway, right? So this was a case where they had monthly support for this thing that they were paying for updates. And this was effectively a bug that we were going to fix. And they wanted to find a way to rip people off and sell it as an upgrade. And that's just wrong. It was a wrong way to treat the users. I ended up just not doing it. I quit that job about 6 weeks later anyway.
Other reasons or for that reason?
I was just job hopping a lot. It was complicated, right? I hated all my jobs, but I didn't understand why. Like, I hated every programming job I had because of this. Looking back, that's why I hated it, because I didn't, it wasn't about making better software for people. It was about how can we make money? How can we do this so that people will be addicted to it and use it and keep giving us money for it? And what?
I mean, addicted. You mean rely on it, especially when it comes with
rely helplessly, right? I mean, that's the whole point of proprietary software. Rely on it. So how do we get them locked into us?
Right. Absolutely.
Locked into us and no one else. And so no other software will do it. And they have to keep coming crawling to us over and over again. How do we get them to come crawling to us over and over again?
So how did you move from best business practices to software freedom should be your right?
Oh, that was because I switched to system administration. Because I didn't understand any of this at the time. I thought, I just hate development. That was what I had.
And I hate business.
What I was saying in my head. Well, yeah, I always...
corporations are scummy.
That was true. I didn't even think I figured that out at that point either. I just decided I must hate software development. I felt pretty horrible because I was like, I trained to be a software developer. I just hate software development. That's what it is. Because I thought that was software development. I mean, realize the context, right? This is pre-Googling around for stuff didn't exist. There was no search engines. I mean, AltaVista was sort of there.
Archie
and AltaVista had just launched, I think.
I mean, I found my first recipe online using, I think it was Archie.
Yeah. But anyway, the point was it was very difficult. Other than Usenet, it was very difficult to sort of interact with people. And most people doing free software were doing it as part, like Larry Wall was doing it as part of his job at JPL and other places. So people had jobs that just seemed to let them do this stuff that was really interesting, but you had to work to get to those jobs where you could actually do cool stuff. You had to pay your dues or whatever. And I was like, I just hate software development so much, I can't do it. So I switched to system administration. The joke I always just tell is that I found another area of computing I could do that's much more enjoyable and people treat you well and all this sort of thing. It was called system administration. So I became, I'm sorry, you all call it dumb. I'm sorry, I'm offending these young people who think they're better than being a system administrator. I think system administrators are great and important people. And so I, if they want to say DevOps, that's fine, but don't be hard on people who want to say system administration, because that's what it is. So I took jobs doing sysadmin work. That's where I became a zealot, because being a skilled developer and seeing bugs in operating systems that I was supporting. So I found bugs in Solaris and bugs in other operating systems or system software that I was supporting. And even if we were paying for support, they wouldn't close our bugs, in part because they would say, oh, well, you know, this is not an important enough bug for us. We're not going to close it. And being a sysadmin is what convinced me to really think proprietary software was trying to hurt me. It was clear, because I would go around to users and be like, I can't fit. They would report a bug. I would try to fix it. And I would hit a bug in a low underlying operating system. I used to run strace on all the Solaris binaries to catch where the system calls were happening that broke, because that's the best I could get, because I didn't have source code. So I'd run strace, I'd find where the bug was, I'd report it down. I'd get it down to a couple of lines of saying, this is where the problem is. Once I found a bug that strace, I could clearly see it was an argument swap thing where it took arg A and B and they called it with B comma A instead of A comma B. And I was like, if you switch those two args and recompile it, it will probably just work. That's the bug. You called B comma A instead of A comma B. And they wouldn't do it. Mm. And I remember at one point, like for that situation, trying to download a binary editor of some sort to see if I could like edit the binary to switch the args or something. Cause I didn't have assembly. I didn't have the object code. So I couldn't even use an assembler or something. I had to like edit the object code somehow. And I was like, this is insane. I remember thinking, this is stupid. I'm not going to fix this. I'm just going to tell everybody to live with it. I'm just going to be the bastard operator from hell type person. Just like, screw you. I'm not fixing it. Because I was angry that they wouldn't fix it for me. So I was just going to be a jerk to all my users and be like, screw you. I don't care. I have a workaround. And because you guys use the system different than me. And that's the kind of thing that sort of made me realize, like, this is what you do. This is why people in the computing, this is why sysadmins are jerks, right? Because they face this kind of situation. They can't fix it and they feel bad. And so the way they deal with feeling bad is just treat other people bad. And I basically saw
not everybody, but
yeah. But I think it's hard not to fall into that after this experience over and over again. The vendor just screws you over and over again, and there's nothing you can do. You feel helpless, and that feeling of helplessness, that's what turned me into free software zealot, because I became convinced that basically the computing industry would be full of people who just hated the world. And I was going to hate the world if I had to be in that computing industry.
So interesting. I think actually for me, it was also a feeling of helplessness that made me passionate as well. I hadn't thought about it in that way before hearing you say that. But I think that's sort of maybe how it works, right? Is when you feel powerless and you feel helpless, and it seems like it should be so simple in many ways. It galvanizes you. It's really interesting.
Yeah, I think that this actually is completely related to the thing you and I argue about all the time, which is that I believe that free software can really only, or the software freedom message can only convince developers, because I think that I've discovered that many non-technical users feel that same helplessness that I would feel. But I only felt it because it was proprietary software, because I was like, if I had the source code, I would open it up and work with it.
I think that maybe you, because of who you are, and because of your history and your experience, I think you're better equipped to understand developers and what they will respond to. Whereas, I think that there is a message for non-technical people as well.
I don't know what it is. I never know what to say to them, right? Because they feel helpless using GNOME 3, right? And
no.
Some people do.
Some people do, but
right?
Some people,
Or they feel hopeless using any given free software that has a bug, right? Because software has tons of bugs.
But when they inquire about GNOME 3, then, then they have the experience of having, or at least, so there's a fantastic human rights lawyer based in New Zealand, her name is Suzanne, but let me get her last name. She's also worked on really cool bits of legislation. Suzanne Ruthman. She's really cool. She is basically married to a Debian person, and so kind of like came into it that way. And I had this conversation with her because I wanted to understand how non-technical people could become so passionate about software freedom, because she's helped with the organization of LinuxConf Australia, is really cool. And so I was asking her about her use of software and her use of GNOME. And I asked her if she was using GNOME, because I knew she was using Debian. And she said, how do I know if I'm using GNOME 3? And so I told her, and I asked her what it looked like. And she was, in fact, using GNOME 3. And so I asked her about the transition from GNOME 2 to GNOME 3. And she says, I don't know what you're talking about. And I said, do you remember when everything changed? And she said, oh, yes, I remember when everything changed. That was a really terrible day. but when she, so she had a really hard time transitioning from 2 to 3. But when she started inquiring on the things that were frustrating her, she got the help she needed. And now she's really, she loves it and is a great advocate for it. And I sort of feel like if we can understand, I think what's funny is that I think people often see me as a non-technical person in the free and open source software world, but hilariously, I'm way too technical to be able to understand someone who's not technical. I'm coming from an early programming background like you. I was, programming in BASIC, actually younger than you. It's just sort of, I think I may have gotten a you know, access to
I
Unix machines.
I would have started younger if I had had a computer.
Oh, I'm not saying I'm not privileged, you know, like, but my dad was also an engineer, and he loved showing, you know, we had a computer from the, I grew up with punch cards around the house, and, you know, I remember, you know, looking at the punch cards going through the machine and like imagining what animals they look like. And my dad saw my interest. And so he took me around all of the computer equipment and showed me what everything was and explained to me how everything worked. And so this was, and then as soon as we could have a computer in our house, we had one because he needed it for work and he loved it too. So I mean, I feel really privileged to have had all of that access from a very early age. But really, I mean, I don't even know how old I was when I wrote my first little, you know, Karen Rules program. Go to 10. But it was very, very young, and so it's impossible for me to imagine, you know, this attitude about computers has been, you know, my attitude since I can even remember what a computer is or what it's for, and that I never hand wrote a paper for school, for example, which for someone of my age is extremely unusual. So that plus I went to engineering school, you know, and then as soon as I went to engineering school, there was like a summer class before the semester began. So, and since I lived in the New York area, I was able to do that. It was like a C and Fortran class. And they gave you an account as soon as you, you know, for the class, you needed one. So I got into the computer lab and it was like, awful. I mean, I've talked about this before in terms of like the experience of women in software generally, but like there were other girls who had come straight from the class to the computer center to get our accounts at the same time who decided they would come back another day because they felt so uncomfortable, based on the attitude in the lab. And when I went to tell the computer center head about it, he said, I just said, just so you know, there are other women who were here with me and they felt uncomfortable and they left. And he said, "You're hired." And I was like, "But I don't, you know, I know some things, but I don't, obviously I don't know it, you know, very much at all." And he called like the top people, the two top people who were, you know, who happened to be there that day. Actually, they were always there, and called them into his office and said, "Teach her everything," you know, and it was really cool. It was really, really cool to have that. Anyway, the whole point of this is to say that, you know, that I'm actually much more technical than I think people think of me as, because I'm now a lawyer and I spent all that time away.
And because our community is sexist, so they assume you're not technical.
Yeah, there is that too. But the point is that it's even hard for me to understand how to advocate better to non-technical people, because I forget what, you know, ordinary, I don't know what that means, but ordinary people know and don't know, what non-technical people know and don't know. I'm just
Beth Flanagan calls them muggles.
Really? Yeah. So it's tough, but I do find that I can get people to care. And what's tough is that the way that I get them to care for me is talking about my medical condition and the pacemaker defibrillator, but it only starts there. And I feel like because I can get them from the, I could die, I have this, you know, I need this device, here's why software is so important to my life. Because I can get them from that to thinking about software as a whole and the ethics of technology generally, I think there's a way. I just think I don't see exactly how to do it yet. And I might not be ultimately the right person to figure that out.
So was it your heart device that caused you to be a zealot?
I think that was the last straw. I think I was heavily down. I mean, you knew me at the time. Mm-hmm. So I think I was heavily down this path. I think that what probably caused me to become a zealot was hanging out with people like you and all of the clients at SFLC who were so passionate. Now, I was writing IRS. My first task as a software freedom law center, a lawyer, was to write applications for tax exempt status to the IRS. So talking about software freedom from a broader perspective, and it's in a greater social context. And so and talking to the developers about their work and why it was important and why they cared, and then helping them over the next few years on different matters and seeing how much people sacrificed and how much they cared about software freedom, that was sort of paved the way. And so I was already pretty much there already. But when I was prescribed the defibrillator and there was no way to look at the code or anything or know who had reviewed it, I really, that's when I had that helplessness. like just that real, and you, I mean, I know you were there with me, and it was just horrible. Now, how can I separate that? I don't know. It was all conflated, right? It was together with the helplessness of having a heart condition, the helplessness of worry, you know, confronting my own mortality, but it solidified all of the work that I had done up until that point.
So what else do we have to tell everybody about why you're a zealot? Is that the final thing? I mean, is that?
No,
is that,
I mean, I mean,
I think people are going to take away from what you just said that it's the primary thing in some sense. So
I'm not sure. I mean, I think there are a lot of reasons. I've been thinking about it a lot recently because I watched the first episode of Silicon Valley, which I don't know. I think you've watched, but
I'm only one episode behind. Yeah.
Oh, okay. I only saw that one episode. I'm not sure.
As we record, it's last night, so.
I'm not sure if I'm going to watch any more of them. I'm not really a huge TV watcher, but you actually said I should check it out, so I did.
Well, it's because it's relatively accurate.
Well, I mean, some things are exaggerated, and you know, some things are jokes.
The whole world is exaggerated. I mean, that's the.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of good commentary there for sure. Yeah, but what was interesting is that so they have that party in the first episode. And there's like this whole, you know, Kid Rock plays and nobody cares and all this stuff. And it does, you've said it has echoes of some of the parties that we've gone to, around the conferences.
And the OpenStack parties in particular. Yeah.
I actually think it was totally different than that. But, but other than the fact that there were a lot of fine cocktails at the OpenStack
and free party. Fiji water for all, it's like we
But what really kept striking me was that there throughout the whole episode there were these references to social justice, and you know, and like,
well, that's the theme through the whole series.
Is it?
We're making the world a better place.
Yeah.
By doing stupid stuff.
And it made me so, yeah, by doing something that's just by developing our product.
Yep.
And I think that this is one of the major problems that Software Freedom has, is that it's like we're talking. In some ways, it's related to this co-option of the software freedom messaging that message that we've both talked about, but you and especially in your talk recently, where you make a comparison to the environmentalist movements. So some of it is a co-option of the software freedom message, but part of it is like a distortion, and it's tough because I can understand why the IRS, when they look at free and open source software, you know. When they look at free and open source software organizations, why they might not be able to determine which ones deserve status and which ones don't. Because jargon like this is, using that really dilutes the whole thing, and it confuses things. So I was talking to a friend who had recently had an interview.
I would think if anybody, the IRS could discern it, though, right? If anybody can, the people who read C3 applications all the time should be able to.
Maybe, but when you talk about software products...
Yeah. Well,
like they think of it in terms
with
of
OpenStack,
what is
getting
is this
their
a
initial denial.
Yeah.
I mean, that's sort of a similar situation where there's.
But that's a trade association denial. So
yeah,
it's a little bit different.
Even,
but
it's even
amazing.
Worse in some sense because it's like you can't even get, which is a lower bar for C6 than C3.
Well, it's just a different bar. I mean,
yeah,
it's
but
a
you
common
get
business
you get
interest.
Less stuff.
Well, so there.
Because you don't get tax deductible donations. So you get,
don't,
you
but
get
you
less
have
stuff.
You do get advantages. So they yeah. have to show that it's in some ways it's harder because you have to show that it's a common business interest and not just trying to put a competitor out of business, right?
But, like, yeah, which is what you're basically not just, the IRS is saying is that you guys are just all getting together trying to kill Amazon.
Right. So,
which might be true.
I mean, you know, so
the IRS might be right.
It's a tough analysis for both the C6s and the C3s. And so a friend of mine was interviewing for a sysadmin position, and he was asked,
I hope he didn't say sysadmin because they won't hire him unless he says DevOps.
I think they were advertising for a sysadmin, actually, because I did read the job description. But
who would want to work in a place that still hires sysadmins and not DevOps people?
Well, anyway, it was one of the many companies that talk about social justice.
They must be the same places that hire the COBOL people, too.
Well, a lot of companies now have, like, social justice is like a, you know... And there was all the jokes in Silicon Valley kind of mm-hmm. support that as a corporate mission, which suits them when it suits them, and mm-hmm. when it doesn't, it's out the window. And so this interviewer asked my friend what he thought about issues of social justice, and could he show of an example where he's passionate about social justice? And he said, well, you know, I care about free and open source software, and he said he could practically hear the eye roll on the other side of the phone And he was telling me this in at a party. So there were other people around, and they were like, yeah, I mean, who cares? I mean, like, he's talking about software freedom. Is that really social justice? And I said, well, you know, if we talk about, I said, you know, what do you think when you hear the term access to technology? And everyone around the room was like, oh, well, that's totally different. I said, that makes you think about, you know, real social good. And they said, yes. And it's like, it's so much of this is wrapped up in the rhetoric. And software freedom encompasses a lot of these concepts. But in order to have, you know, but in order to have ethical technology, we sort of need a lot of different pieces from both from software freedom and from other areas as well. And so, I don't know, I'm kind of rambling on a little bit.
This is exactly why we're entering the Dark Ages, right? This is exactly why. Because we are separating the cloistered monks from everybody else. And we're using the church of wow, cool technology, cool toys to separate them. And basically,
this is why I think it's so important to talk about it and to find ways that we can explain why it's so important.
Oh, I think that we can write for history to show that there were people on the side of right on the other side 100 years from now, but or more. But yeah, we're our gross is cooked. There's no turning back from what's going to happen, I think.
I know you think that, but that's very depressing. And I guess, despite the fact that I'm a trained pessimist by being a lawyer, I'm at heart an optimist. And I really just feel like if we can find those areas like the medical devices situations where we can demonstrate this emotional connection and the importance of ethical technology, I think there's an opportunity. I hate to think about the fact that we probably will have some more massive failures in the near future, which will also underscore, I mean, conflating security with software freedom is certainly convenient from time to time to advocate for it, but there really is something to be said about that, showing the differences between how what happens when there is a security failure in a proprietary software solution and a free and open source software one is great for being able to advocate our message, showing how advantageous for society it is when we free ourselves from single vendors, showing how we need software freedom to build a civilization. That if we think about, you know, what kind of world we want to create, what kind of infrastructure we want to create that we're relying on, instead of taking the ad hoc corporate solutions with proprietary software that we've been doing, when we think more holistically as a society, we can sort of see how software freedom fits into this. And this is where I sort of feel like we need to all become advocates, and we need to all start talking about this stuff, because otherwise we really will be in the Dark Ages, which you think we will be in anyway. So maybe to you, this is a waste of time. But to me, I think this is incredibly important. And by talking about it, it means that we're much more likely to get written into history.
Well, yeah,
I'm not as interested.
I'm not sure how we key. I mean, we also have the problem of carbon dioxide emissions, and that we probably won't. Most of the stuff we have, we won't have. So it's probably true that the next generation of computing will have to be built slowly from scratch again. Because if there's enough recorded and written out free software, maybe it won't be built as a proprietary software industry. Because we're probably going to, I mean, we're basically, most of the government's probably going to collapse and all that. over the fact that, I mean, I'm talking in the next 200 years, right?
Because I hope I live long enough to get a hint.
Of which thing's going to happen?
A hint of what's
the hope
happen.
That I'm going to be wrong, that you get to see that I'm going to be wrong.
Yeah.
I mean, I think we have, I don't think it's going to happen so quickly. I mean, I think we have our lives, but in the next couple of generations, we're going to face that. So this is why I think that the software freedom's a tough issue to be that concerned about, because there are bigger issues in the world. There are much worse issues in the world.
Absolutely. But this is sort of like the way I think about software freedom is it's a building block issue, right? It's a fundamental infrastructure.
I think the only reason I work on it is basically selfish reasons. I do software freedom as a social justice cause because it's so personal to me. Because I wanted to be a computer scientist, and I couldn't become a computer scientist because I would have to eventually sell.
But you don't disagree with my point that we're building fundamental infrastructure that our society relies on, and that we will be so much better off, that a civilization requires that our code is shared.
I agree with you, but I don't think it's complicated in the sense that if and this is why I understand, even though I don't agree with why so many people in computing are obsessed with issues of privacy and spying and government over control using computer technology, and corporate over control of using computer technology like Google or Facebook, that sort of thing. The reason those issues end up getting linked, I think, is because that the society where the software is proprietary, or even just web service that you don't have the source code to, we're not actually collaborating on the infrastructure of our life as far as technological life. Mm-hmm. So that's why I think
right. those I issues I are connected. I conflate these issues, but it's true. They're all interrelated.
Well, and I think that the software freedom issue might be low on the list compared to a lot of other issues. I think the main problem we have in our society is not the main problem we have in our society, but a problem we have in social justice advocacy is no one will take anybody else's issues seriously. I work relatively hard to do better than my peers in taking seriously. I mean, I'm sitting there with a T60 that I bought used, and I'm picking the T60s now because they run Core Boot, and other ones don't, but I've always bought used hardware even before the Core Boot question, because I always felt it was right to buy used hardware, and lots of people in our community refused. I used to work at SFLC, did not end well, but there was effectively.
Well, it ended well in that we were doing this. I don't know.
True. Well, most of it didn't end well. But one of the things that happened at SFLC is there was basically a revolt of the policy that I set that we would buy used hardware. And basically people started buying hardware. Like basically I stopped being in charge of approving purchases because people were so obsessed with buying new hardware at SFLC. And so that's an example of people who were ostensibly supposed to be working towards this software freedom cause. I don't think most of the people there were. That's another story.
I think you
were. And you happily used hardware the whole time. I should note.
Yeah, although I really do like my new-ish Zarezan.
But I mean, that's the little bit that I try to do is so. I try to not buy stuff. I don't try not to let my stuff land in landfills. I'm trying to like rescue dogs. I rescue dogs as well. But also rescue computer hardware that otherwise would get landfilled or badly, you know, would sort of end. I mean, I use hardware till it's die. I'm still using, you do this too. I'm still using the HTC Dream that Google gave me in 2008 or something because it's not broken. And so why not use a phone that's still working? Like, there's no reason to switch phones.
I had a broken screen, but thankfully, Allison Chicken.
Yeah, Allison Chicken donated
her phone. So thank you, Allison.
But you still have the broken screen when you didn't get rid of it, right?
No, it still works. So I'm
curious because I have a non-working keyboard. I've been wondering if we could take it. HTC Dream apart.
I wonder.
I have no idea if you can take the. It seems you should be able to resolder the connector to the screen of the keyboard.
We should totally talk about this. But this is.
But my point. But the reason I'm bringing all this up is that you know, we put some effort into these environmental causes, other causes, I think that it's very difficult to, and for example, all the conservancy paper, I buy 100% and make sure at least has 50% post-consumer, right? But if I'm really good, I would get 100% post-consumer.
There's only so much you can do, right? Like, I mean, there are only so many causes you can volunteer for. I've been working a lot on the Cooper Union. We, part of the committee to save Cooper Union, we just...
I made the local news recently, you know.
Yeah, totally. Because we finally launched the lawsuit against Cooper Union to keep it tuition free, so you guys could check that out if you want. But that's a side issue. So it's you can only do so much. You know, you've got your causes, but but we try to be true to as many social good causes as we can.
Well, I think most people don't. I think most people, they lock into their issues or
they don't think about it.
It's too overwhelming. And
technology, and this is why it's so insidious, is that software in particular, it's underlying everything that we, not everything, but almost everything that we do now. And we create these, we take these like proprietary corporate driven infrastructure that we then wholly weave into our lives and our business and our society. And we're not thinking of it in terms of like a fundamental building block and that we have choices as a society. And this is where, I think that software freedom is really important and where we need to be explaining ourselves better. That it's sort of, it's not something that's particularly visible, you know, but it is underlying everything. And
Yeah, I mean, I would like to believe that were true. I don't actually believe it's true because I think that I'm selfishly focused on this cause because it's the
which
one
part don't
the
you
most.
Not believe is true that we can convince people or that that's true that there's fundamental
oh
that,
I don't,
that
I don't
software th- is
well,
a
both,
fundamental
actually I don't think we can convince people and I'm not sure software is that fundamental compared to other issues, you know, and when people that there's food and water issues. And there's
but software
people
winds
sold
up
into
being
slavery a, still. And,
oh, I totally agree with you. I totally agree with you, obviously. But I do think that software is underlying a lot of things that touch on all of those points as well. I mean, this is like, you know, that is why me having that implantable medical device changed the way I think about it. Because suddenly I'm talking about something that touches my heart. Right, I'm talking about something that my life relies on. That's serious, and it's not just me; it's a lot of people.
Right,
right. And then we're talking about access to technology across a huge swath of people in very different geographically diverse areas, and with different needs and different. And anyway, so
but you have a better excuse in some sense because it affects your life or death situation. Whereas for me, it was just I couldn't be in my chosen career.
But you are relying on software for your life and death every day.
True, I agree with you, but.
It's just seeing it is much harder.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know.
This is why the cyborg lawyer thing winds up having so much impact is because it's a way to talk about it because I can say, you know, I'm at a very high risk of dying and I rely on this software and it's, you know, screwed into my heart. But the reason why it has impact is because there's something, you know, really true about it and I'm trying to find ways to explain it to other people. And part of the reason why I wanted to have this discussion about why we care about software freedom is because we take it for granted, as you were saying at the beginning of the show. Like, we sort of take our commitment to software freedom for granted, and we also take it for granted that a lot of the developers that we talk to feel the same way or understand where we're coming from. And I think that isn't always the case.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think a lot of developers, I mean, the one of the reasons that I'm critical of myself for basically being selfish to work on software freedom as opposed to some more important social justice cause is that I think a lot of developers take that selfishness even a step further. I think a lot, and this is relates to the giant sucking sound of talent to Google. I think that most developers I have met are easily distracted by interesting technical problems. Mm-hmm. And they will easily let themselves do things that they would, if sort of thinking in the abstract, would say, well, that's not so good. But they'll sort of let themselves be part of a system or part of a machine or part of a culture or whatever it is to push forward something they don't even agree with that much, right? Right. People who work for Google don't like that Google tracks everything you do and mm-hmm. so forth. And that they, you know, the EU gets this decision against them and says, oh, well, you can't try, you know, you have to give our users a way to opt out. And it's like, they're only going to implement it in Europe instead of worldwide. Like they basically somehow, you know, and they made a free speech argument in the press. I don't know if you heard this, but they made a free speech argument in the press that, like, oh, having access to all the information about somebody is free speech. It's like, well, what they really want is their own access to information about
right.
you. And Facebook's worse in this regard, and Facebook's much worse, really. But I think that people will easily be part of it just to work on the technical problem that interests them the most, right? To get to work on their free software project that interests them. I think that it makes it easier, and this is about the co-option, to say, oh, well, what I'm working on is open source, as they'll say. So it's all open source. It's all out there. You know, it's all out there, man. You know, the code's all out there.
Yeah.
Or to say, well, even release the code of the Google search engine, you couldn't use it anyway. So what's the point? Don't worry about it. And all those kinds of justifications that people come to.
I mean, the way I've started thinking about it is free software is a fundamental, it's like a cornerstone, it's a fundamental building block of ethical technology, but it's only one piece.
Of ethical technology, right? I mean, the question is that how important is technology when there's these other problems in the world? That's the thing that I question myself about all the time.
Well, of course, but, you know, I mean, there are so many issues to focus on, and we need people to be focusing on lots of different issues, you know? I mean...
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's true. And I feel, when I want to make myself feel better, I think about the fact that there's so many people in the technology. And this is why I like Silicon Valley as a TV show, because there's so many people who just are those people. And they're just so egotistical and just that all they care about is their own power and money and everything. And they're basically corrupt people. And most of the technology industry are those type of people. I mean, the free software portion of the technology industry is really tiny compared to everybody who's out there doing it. And so I think long term, it's we've got a huge thing to fight.
Yeah, I mean, I think that as more and more pieces of our society are relying on technology as particularly interoperating with one another, I think that the issue becomes more and more important, because all of the ability to address the other problems that are important in our society, the social good causes that that are definitely trump ours, will, you know, are continuously starting to rely more and more on software.
Well, the other thing I was thinking recently is, as a society gets more civilized, it has to come up with these more ingenious ways to mistreat people and subjugate people and get people to act certain ways. Because, right, I mean, you can't get away with slavery in the United States anymore. You can't get away with child labor in the United States anymore. You can't get away. There's all these things you can't do in the United States because we've progressed. But the percentage of people who want to exploit are still the same. They just have, and they have no morals, right? They just have to find really ingenious ways to do it, because it's too dangerous to, I mean, not that there aren't people doing, there's slaves in New York City right now that are being brought from other countries, and they use whatever means necessary to force them into forced work or forced sex work sometimes. But those who actually are worried about getting caught for those sort of things, they find these ingenious ways, like the Facebook model of, like, we can exploit people by selling everything about them to advertisers. And, like, that's wrong too. It's not as wrong. But it just happens to be legal right now.
Yeah, I'm not sure that it's, I mean, it's basically trying to increase profits at using whatever methods they possibly can.
Right, and then they make a cost-benefit analysis against what they can get away with and what they can't.
Right? Exactly.
But these people are sociopaths, right? They'll do whatever it takes.
It's like, you know, an effort to find the way to manipulate and exploit people so much as it's to find the way to make the most money possible in the shortest period of time.
Right, but you can always make more money if you mistreat people, right?
Well, hopefully it's not always been true. But it's often true.
It's always true. It's always true in a capitalistic system. Mm. If you can find a way to mistreat people or manipulate people or hurt people, it's always cheaper to hurt people. It's always, I mean, cheaper as far as it costs, which means your profits go up. I mean, think of the car situation where GM just recently didn't tell people that they had this problem because they didn't want to roll out a fix.
Right.
Because it would have taken $2 million off their bottom line.
Right.
You know, this is the society we live in. It's the same as it was in the 1800s. It's just it's not the same, but it's the same types of people. There's just better laws now in the United States and Europe to protect people, but they're not.
And there really ought to be a law about software freedom.
Yeah, but it's so hard to get there, right? Because
the only way we can get there is by talking about it.
True. Okay. So that's what we just did for like a bunch of hours.
Yeah,
so.
That's true. We should. Well, so, thanks for listening.
One big segment too. I guess you're upset we didn't have music in the middle.
I do like the music.
But I almost tried to cut you off before you started telling your story.
Well, people will hear it now at the end. Now we can slowly fade out to the music. Praise and Freedom is produced by Dan Lynch of Pod Factory and can be found at podfactory.org. Thanks to Mike Tarantino for our theme music. This episode of Praise and Freedom is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 United States license. You can follow Praise and Freedom, Bradley, and Karen on Identica, and also read Bradley's and Karen's blogs. Links can be found on the Praise and Freedom website, faif.us. That's FAIF.us.
And we had built all this software to run on a particular database. It was the Informix database products that we used. All our software relied on it because everything made calls back to the database. So we would write the software and call to the database to do all the important work. Now, after a while, I started to discover bugs in my programs, like any programmer would. And one time, I spent a number of weeks just tracking down this one single bug. I was a young, naive programmer, and but I knew one rule, that if you had a bug, you should get the software down to a few lines that could exhibit that bug, you know, sort of a test case that would exemplify the bug, and then you could audit that code line by line and see where the bug was. So I did that. I had about 20 or 30 lines of code that would just immediately exhibit the bug, nothing else there, and I audited it, and I couldn't find what the bug was. So I took it to one of the senior programmers where I was working named Greg and said, Greg, could you look over this code? I've had this bug for a few weeks now and I just can't find it. I guess I'm just missing something. And he too audited my code line by line, checking it. And after about 20 minutes, he said, there's no bug in here at all. In fact, I think it's a bug in the underlying Informix libraries that talk to the database. And I said, no, that can't be the case. See, I was naive enough to think that if you got software in a box with shrink wrap on it from a company, that it couldn't have bugs in it. So I argued with Greg for a while, and he said, no. I've been using Informix for a number of years, and they have tons and tons of bugs in their software. But we have a tech support number that we can call. It's an 800 number. You call up and you can file a bug report, and they'll get back to you and tell you how to fix it or to work around it. So I called in and I dutifully described this bug to the fellow on the other end of the phone at Informix Software. I even emailed him that 30 lines of source code that it would exhibit the bug so he could run it himself and see. The next day I got a call back and he said, yeah, this is a bug. And no, I don't know when there's going to be a fix for the 3B2 system. Can I close out the bug report, please? I said, well, wait a second. I've lost a couple of weeks here on this bug. And what do you mean there's no fix for the 3B2 Unix system? Are there fixes for other platforms that you run on? He said, oh, yeah, it looks like this bug has been fixed on Sun systems for a long time, but the bug fix is really Sun-specific, and it won't work on the 3B2. Now, this was a very surreal moment because we had to become experts on this 3B2 environment. It had some strange quirks to it that weren't common among other Unix-like systems. If I was looking at the source code he was looking at, I probably could have figured out what would make it work on the 3B2 and fix the bug for that system. And if I couldn't figure out, Greg probably could have. He'd been working with it for a lot longer than I had. But I couldn't get the source code. In fact, I didn't even want to ask this guy for it, even though he was sitting on the other end of the phone looking at it. Because I'd learned 8 years earlier what happens when you ask someone for software who doesn't want to share it with you. And I knew a little bit more than that by that point as well. I knew that this fellow on the end of the phone had likely signed a non-disclosure agreement with Informix. This, too, was quite surreal. He got a job called Tech Support for Programmers. And then he had to sign an agreement to promise not to help any programmers. Because the most natural way that two software developers, two programmers help each other is to share the source code, to share software, to email back and forth and say, here's where my problem is, do you have it on your end? And then work out the solution. But this guy just had to sit on the other end of the phone and say, yes, it's a bug. No, I don't know when it'll be fixed. Could I please close out the bug report? This had to be a demoralizing experience for him. It certainly was for us. We would lose weeks at a time because of some Informix bug or another and get the same sort of answers. Sometimes they would give us a workaround. Sometimes maybe there was a patch. But most of the time, we just had to figure out for ourselves. We were left helpless because of the bugs in this other software. My employer wouldn't have minded if I was fixing Informix's bugs for them. They wanted their software to work, to do the blood test results right, and to store them in the database correctly. They didn't care whose software we had to fix to make that happen. They just wanted the software to work right. But we couldn't do that. We had to report back to them and tell them, we can't fix it because we don't have the source code. And it turned out that this wasn't an isolated experience. The rest of my career turned out much the same as I worked in the various different types of proprietary software jobs. After a while, I just became apathetic about the whole idea of software development. So I'd heard about this other thing you could do if you had computer science experience that was a much easier job and you just sat around all day and told people to go away and you didn't have to do any work at all. It was called system administration. Now, once I took one of these jobs, I realized that all these misconceptions were, in fact, misconceptions. But at the time, I thought, well, this is an easy way to have a career in computer science, and I don't have to do software development. But quite quickly, I discovered the same sorts of problems in that area of computer science. My first system administration job professionally was working for Westinghouse. I supported their mobile wireless telephone division that built satellite telephones. They're primarily used for things like forestry services and disaster recovery, other places where a cellular system would be down or not exist. So they were pretty specific high-end products. The development environment for this mobile telephone system was built on a Solaris installation running version 2.4 of Solaris, which was old at the time. However, they'd done a full ISO 9000 certification and regression test on their software to make sure that their build environment worked properly. So upgrading was not something we could do easily. We'd have to go through regression testing again on the build environment. So we had to stick with the older versions and just install security updates and any sort of critical patch, nothing for as far as new software and that sort of thing. So I started working there, and one of the first problems they had for me to solve that had been a real pain for them for a while, one of the reasons they even hired a sysadmin, was that every morning it turned out that some people would sit down at their workstations and could log in fine, and other people would sit down at their workstations, but they couldn't log in. They type in their username and their password correctly, but it would tell them login incorrect and wouldn't let them get into the system. So they asked me to track this down. I discovered that there was some strange thing, that if you logged in had logged in the last 12 hours, that you could sit down at your own terminal and log in just fine. So people who had logged in remotely to their own desktop system overnight via the modem dial-up pool or some other way were just fine. So what people would do is they would go to somebody else's terminal, remotely log into their own machine, and then go back to their own terminal and be able to log in just fine. This is just the strange interaction of the bug. So what would happen is the half of the people that couldn't log in the morning would all wander to each other's to the other people's cubicles and find somebody who had an active window open, log into their own computer, then go back to their own desk. Now this wasted about a half an hour or 45 minutes every morning, because people would wander into each other's cubicles and talk for a while and so forth. So I had to solve this problem so we didn't waste so much time trying to get logged in the morning. The bug turned out to be in the NIS Plus system, a proprietary software authentication system produced by Sun. And it was an interaction bug between that software and something called XDM, the X Display Manager. The two didn't work together properly. XDM was what asked you for your password. NIS Plus was what checked it against the database, and they didn't talk together right. So I looked on Sun's website for a bug fix for Solaris 2.4, and I discovered that they had indeed fixed a number of other bugs, very similar, related to NIS Plus, but hadn't fixed this one. So I called into Sun Tech Support again, and like I always had to do at any of these jobs when I found a bug in proprietary software, call up tech support. And they said, yep, yeah, we know about that bug, and it's not fixed for Solaris 2.4, and we don't know when there'll be a patch. Of course, I was used to dealing with this, so I got a little aggressive and said, well, you fixed all these other bugs related to this. Why not fix this one? They said, well, NASA asked for those other bug fixes, and they're running Solaris 2.4 as well, and they're big enough to demand us to fix these kinds of bugs. But you're just not a big enough company to demand for us to fix a bug like that. You're just a small company. I was surprised to learn that Westinghouse is a small company. But in fact, apparently it was, even though we had a division of 180 people right there at the one site of many. So I had to go back to the users and deliver that same message that I hated getting myself. Yes, this is a bug. No, I don't know when it'll be fixed. Let's just hope that somebody logged in overnight each day so that somebody has an active window so we can go to that person's desk and log in. This will have to be the permanent solution. Now, this isn't to say that free software is without bugs. We have our share in free software. Some will argue we have more than our share in free software. This is not even to say that the original developer or distributor of a particular free software program will care about your bug. They might be like Sun and say, no, you're too small, I don't care about your bug. But the difference and how the situation would have been different if the software were free software would be that you had the means to fix the problem yourself, that you had the freedom to fix it or to hire anyone you want to fix it. If we weren't happy with the support we were getting from Sun, and it had been free software, we could have hired someone else to support it. I could have done it myself, probably. I knew enough about programming to do it, I think. But if I didn't, I could have gotten my manager to hire somebody else instead of paying Sun for their support to tell us those kind of things.